This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting today from the Knight Studio at the Newseum, Washington, D.C.'s newest museum devoted to journalism and the news business. For almost 3 years, from 2003 to 2006, Scott McClellan fielded questions from reporters in the White House briefing room every day as President Bush's press secretary, questions about Iraq and Afghanistan, questions about how the administration responded to Hurricane Katrina, and questions about how CIA operative Valerie Plame's name was leaked to the press. After leaving the administration, Scott McClellan wrote a book critical of his boss, the people he worked with, and the current state of American politics. It's called What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. In just a minute, he joins us to talk about it, and it's the first time he'll be taking questions from the public. There is, of course, also a little political news today, too. Senator Barack Obama clinched the Democratic nomination last night. You might have heard something about that. And he and Senator Hillary Clinton spoke at the AIPAC conference here in Washington today. We'll get to that in a bit with guest political junkie, NPR's Washington, senior Washington editor, Ron Elving. But first, it's your chance to ask, what happened? If you have questions for Scott McClellan, give us a call. We have two phone lines today. Republicans can call 800-344-3893. Again, that's 800-344-3893 for Republicans. Democrats, 800-344-3864. The email address is the same, talk@npr.org. You can also weigh in on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And joining us here in the Knight Studio at the Newseum, former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan. Thanks very much for being with us.
Neil, thanks for having me. I look forward to the discussion. And you got a great audience here today. I look forward to their questions as well.
A hell of a week.
It has been quite a week, going back and forth between New York and Washington. I'm glad to be back in Washington for at least this afternoon, then back to New York again.
Did you anticipate the level of vitriol that's been directed at you from your former colleagues and from the White House?
I was a little surprised by it. I expected a pretty strong reaction from some of my former colleagues. I was a little bit surprised by how personal some of it has become. It's really interesting that they really aren't refuting the larger themes and perspectives that are written in the book, but engaging in some of these personal attacks that really are part of the problem with Washington that I talk about in the book, and it's what we need to get beyond so that we can focus on the bigger issues.
And some people, maybe uncharitably would say, what goes around comes around.
Well, they might say that. I certainly got caught up in this Washington game like everybody else, and I knew that by speaking up on these events that I lived and learned, and what I learned from them was going to stir a little bit of a reaction. I tried to speak openly and honestly in this book so that we can learn from it and that history will benefit from it. But more than anything, I believe that this is a perfect time for this book. Washington needs to change, and it needs to change now in the way that it governs. And this is about improving the way Washington governs so that we can move beyond all the vitriol that you mentioned at the beginning and the partisan warfare that has existed now. It preceded us. It existed now for at least 15 years, how bitter it's become.
One of the things you do in your book is cite examples of other people's books who have in the past pointed out the creation of this constant campaign culture and the kinds
right.
of situations we're in. And, their books didn't change Washington's culture. Why do you think yours will?
Well, maybe their books will get more attention because of my book. This book is certainly getting a lot of attention. I think some of the initial reaction tried to turn the book into gotcha points, and it's really a larger message in the book than that. The larger message, as we were talking about, the permanent campaign culture. And one of the things I talk about in there is the permanent campaign and its future. It's a book that I did during my research as I was working through trying to draw conclusions about why things went so badly off course with this administration. And it really helped me clarify some things in my mind about why that happened. When I came to Washington, I worked for then Governor Bush. He was plus a 70% plus approval rating in Texas, strong bipartisan record. And I was just a young idealistic political person who thought we could do the same here in Washington, and I wanted to know why it didn't turn out that way.
Why don't we get a question from the audience here at the Newseum, up in the microphone to my left.
Sure. Hi, Scott.
Hi.
My name is Felisa Klubis. I'm with part of Johns Hopkins University here in Washington. And first, I'd just like to say I have tremendous respect for the office of the White House Press Secretary, so that I commend you for surviving that position for as long as
I have
you
respect
did.
For it, too.
But my question is this. Why did you choose or allow your book to be released at this time? should you have not waited until President Bush was out of office and even release it on January 21st?
That's a consideration, but I don't think so. These weren't easy words to write. But again, if we're going to change the way Washington works, we need to start addressing these issues head on. Not only that, but I also want to make sure that we don't repeat the same mistakes in the buildup to the war in Iraq again. And you know, there's certainly discussion about going to war in other areas, and I don't want those same mistakes to be repeated. We need to go to war in an honest and forthright way so that the American people know what the expectations are going in.
Thanks.
Sure. Thanks very much for the question. There were earlier versions of this book that were less pointed, I think. There was even an earlier
proposal.
Earlier title to the book that was less pointed. Was there a moment when you had an epiphany?
Well, I think it was over the course of writing the book. I think you're referencing the initial proposal, I think, that I wrote back in December 2006. And really, the themes that developed in this book are in that initial proposal. It was looking at why did this president become such a controversial and polarizing figure? And you know, initially, I was looking at everything else but us in that proposal. I was like, is all these other reasons? It's whoever it may be, the forces on each side of the political aisle that push presidents and push elected leaders to the ideological end of the spectrum so that they don't come together and get things done. But I'm a centrist at heart, and as I went through and was writing this book, I constantly questioned my own interpretations and assumptions of events because I wanted to get to the right conclusions that I felt comfortable with, that it was the truth from my perspective, and I think I've done that.
But was there a day when you said, wait a minute, I've got to go back in and change this. I've got to rework this.
It wasn't a day. It was a process over a long period of time. I put a lot of thought and a lot of hard work into this book and really thought through it carefully so that I could share my experiences with the American people and others who, and for history's sake, it will hopefully benefit this country.
You're a hard guy to get off message.
Well, it's the message in the book. It really is. And it really did take a lot of time working through this manuscript.
Ron Elving?
Scott, I think a lot of us had the feeling that we had gotten to know you during your period of time in that famous podium, being there doing battle with the front row of correspondents day in and day out. We had some idea of who we thought you were, and I'm sure that many of your colleagues in the White House also felt that they had a sure sense of who you were, and an almost uniform response from many of them, and also, of course, from some commentators and columnists and so on, has been that this book sounds so unlike you that they actually imply you might not have written it.
Well, it's interesting. One, that's not true. Even if you have editors working with you, it's your words. These are my beliefs and my words. People that know me and have known me all my life say this is exactly me. And I think White House reporters who know me have also said he's a very straight shooter. And that they know that when I said way back when I was going to write a book and it was going to be candid because I wanted to leave something that we could all benefit from. I think White House reporters have stated that he's speaking from his heart.
Do you feel as though the editing process that you went through with your publisher changed the book in the sense that the proposal was one thing in December of 2006, and in working with these editors and consulting with other people, the content of the book underwent something, a revision?
Well, the conclusions were different from where I may have started. I said that in the preface of the book. I point that out. But I didn't actually start writing this book until about July, sometime probably early July of 2007. And that's when the initial process began, and then it was all the way through, I guess it was about early to mid-April when I finished it. And we missed a couple of early deadlines because I wanted to make sure it was right. I didn't want to rush it. I wanted to make sure that I got things exactly right from my perspective of what I believed about things, and we did.
Another question from the audience here at the museum.
Hi, my name is Daniel Collins. I'm from El Paso, Texas. I wondered, in your opinion, does the restructuring of the intelligence community actually serve to address this culture of secrecy and withholding information, or has it been successful at all?
That's a good question, because in this post 9/11 environment, are we overclassifying things? And that's something, it's not something I look at in the book, but it's something that we, the public, should make sure that is being carefully scrutinized, and I think the media is doing a pretty good job of that, and they need to continue to. But with all the new agencies coming together and the closer coordination, that's a good thing. But let's make sure that we're not over-classifying things and keeping secrets that do nothing to harm our national security.
Thank you. We're taking questions on two different phone lines today. Democrats, 800-344-3864. Republicans, 800-344-3893. But let's get a call in. This is Jennifer from Minneapolis on the Democratic line.
Hi, Mr. McClellan. I wondered, you had talked in your book about how you believed President Bush self-deceived, or he was self-deception, and I wondered if you also deceived yourself about certain things when you were standing up there on the podium talking to reporters about different issues. I know you've had some regrets later now that you've left the White House, but at the time, do you think you were also engaged in self-deception?
Oh, absolutely. It's a very common human trait, and I think we all engage in it at times, and absolutely, I think there are times when I did that. My affection for the president is real. I really like him. I continue to like him personally. One of the hardest things to do during the writing of this book was separating my personal affection from him from his policies and governance. And you had to be able to do that if you're going to arrive at some of these conclusions. And I engaged in it. You get caught up in this atmosphere. You're in Washington. You're working 18-hour-long days. Some of it may be conformity with those around you. But I've always been someone who has come, and I write about it in the book, my upbringing in politics, someone who has believed in governing from the center and focusing on problem solving. But D.C. today is too caught up in the battle for power and influence and the next election, and they lose sight, and deliberation and compromise comes a distant second, and that's unfortunate.
Thanks very much for the call, Jennifer.
Thank you.
And just briefly before we go to a short break, one of your colleagues said when first excerpts of this book I published, I think last December, he spoke with you and said, wait a minute. And you said, oh, it's not going to really come out like that. The book is sort of a distortion.
Well, I hadn't finished the book at that point. I think I said that everybody's reacting to it, and I'm still in the process of writing it, and people need to wait till it's finished.
But he felt deceived. A lot of people in the White House.
I don't think he should have. I think he is someone who has been unable to take off his partisan hat. I did take off my partisan hat, and I accomplished what I wanted to with this book.
Coming up, more on what happened with former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan. We're live at the Knight Studio at the Newseum here in Washington, D.C., and we'll take more of your calls and emails as well. Ron Elving will join us later as our guest political junkie. Ken Rudin is off today. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, broadcasting live today from the Knight Studio inside the Newseum in Washington, D.C. Scott McClellan used to speak for the White House as press secretary. Now he's speaking for himself. His new book, What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception, calls the Iraq War a strategic blunder, a war he helped sell from the podium in the White House press briefing room. He joins us here at the Newseum today, along with NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving. If you'd like to read an excerpt from the book, go to npr.org/talk. And if you'd like to ask a question yourself, well, we have two phone lines today, one for Republicans, 800-344-3893, one for Democrats, that's 800-344-3864. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation, or send us an email question, and that address is talk@npr.org. And, well, Scott McClellan is used to getting questions, well, maybe not quite this pointed. These are some of the questions that he's gotten since writing this book, or the book came out about a week ago.
Some detail. Why didn't you say to him, Mr. President, this is the fundamental issue confronting our country? Why didn't you go to your superiors and say, guys, ladies and gentlemen, we have a problem here. This is the fundamental issue, choice or necessity, and the president seems unaware of it.
Weren't you the ultimate complicit enabler, though? I asked a tough question before the Iraq War, and you personally called an executive at NBC News, and you threatened to deny access to us.
I did?
Yes, you did, once the war began.
What do you say about that? The entire presidency was a facade of public manipulation.
I don't agree that.
Enjoying yourself?
If it takes talking about unpleasant truths to force some change in Washington, then I'm all for it. People are now discussing this book. They're starting to read it. They're starting to see for themselves my sincerity in the book, and that's a good thing. And they're starting to realize that there is that larger message there. You know, I didn't expect that it would be quite this much attention, but I do welcome it. And this is something that I will continue to focus on even after the book tour is over.
Now let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Rob, and Rob's with us from Hilltown in Pennsylvania on the Republican line.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Very well, thanks.
I just have two quick questions. My first one is, didn't your administration see any flags or when you guys were making the decision to go to war? Like I said to my wife, I said, you know, Colin Powell made this case between the before the UN, and all of a sudden the guy just kind of faded out of the woodwork. And I know he's a very conservative man and takes all you know, things into consideration before making a move. And from my understanding is he kind of wanted the administration to hold off, and they kind of just kind of said, nope, you know, let's kind of move him out of here. Second question, I'm a Republican. I voted for this guy. It just seems like this guy, Bush, is just so insulated and just doesn't really – I mean, look at the Baker Commission with that report that came back with. He basically really didn't even listen to it. I mean, I don't know. What's the guy's deal?
Well, on the first part of your question about Colin Powell, I think you're – pretty, your assessment is pretty much right on. He was probably one of the lone dissenters, if you will, in the build-up to the war, who was saying, go slow, you don't have to do this, Mr. President. But what happened was that there was no flexibility left in the approach. I mean, the president, and I say this in the book, I believe, after having become press secretary, first of all, when in the build-up to the war, I was the deputy press secretary. Most of my focus was elsewhere on other priorities, but I did fill in from time to time for my predecessor. I did participate in a couple of the White House Iraq group meetings, which were set up to basically market the war to the American people. With the second part of the question, what was that again?
What's the deal with this guy?
The insulation. I think this happens to every president to an extent. It's something you've got to counter for. You've got to watch, and his senior advisors have to make sure that he's getting a diversity of viewpoints. He did get to an extent, but not close enough to where it needed to be, of bringing more people in and bringing critics in, bringing expert critics in that have different points of view to make sure they're challenging the president's thinking. What happened, and I say this in the book, is that his advisor, I think his national security advisor, Condi Rice, was too accommodating of the president and too accommodating of some of the other strong personalities around the table, which was weighted with the vice president, Secretary Rumsfeld, against Secretary Powell, basically, in the build-up to the war. And they should have been more challenging to the president's thinking. But once the president makes a decision, he says, you know, I expect everybody to follow it. There is no dissent about the decision once it's made. And he had made the decision very early on that we were going to confront Saddam Hussein, and it was either he comes clean or we remove the regime. There was no flexibility whatsoever in the plan, and there probably should have been flexibility. As a press secretary, one of the things I always did was leave myself some flexibility so I didn't tie the president's hands. That didn't happen with the build-up to the war.
Hmm. Thanks,
hey,
Rob.
Thanks for your help.
Yep, thanks.
Appreciate it. Question from here at the museum.
Okay. My name is Sydney Wolk, and I'm from Silver Spring, Maryland. And my question is, Scott, if you became president, what would you do or change?
I don't have any intention of running anytime soon. I don't have any intention of running really ever. I'll never say never. But what I would change is this White House has been too secretive and too compartmentalized and not open and candid enough. And the first thing you've got to have if you're going to change the atmosphere in Washington is an embrace of openness and candor. Government in the sunshine is something I've always been taught about. I was raised in a political family. My mother was an elected official, a trailblazer for women in politics back in the late 70s and early 80s. And I was very young at that, around your age. And I was taught the importance of public service. I was taught the importance of speaking up and making a positive difference and solving problems. I wasn't taught a very ideological, rigid approach to things. I was taught that politics is about compromise. And if you're going to have trust between yourself and those across the aisle, then you've got to have openness and candor, and you've got to give that to the American people, too. We didn't do that in the build-up to the war, and that's why this presidency veered so terribly off course.
Thank you.
Yes.
Here's an email question from Danny in Oakland, California. Given the grave harm the administration's lies have caused our country and military and your part in perpetrating those lies, is it possible for you to make a simple declarative statement just about yourself that you lied? If you could, I'd feel much more forgiving toward you for what you've done.
Well, I certainly did with the leak episode, unknowingly. I passed along false information because I was assured of certain things. In terms of the others, I engaged in the political spin and manipulation just like everybody else, got caught up in this game, and I wish I hadn't. But I, you know, most of what I was said back then I really believe was sincere, but some of it in reflection is I view as misguided. And you know, we get into this is a very good question. This is part of where the hatred and venom in Washington really comes into play. Both sides, tend to look at each other. There are a lot of good people that come here for the right reasons to make a positive difference. But both sides tend to get caught up in looking at each other as enemies. We're not enemies. We're working together to try to solve problems. And when you start engaging in lie, you start implying it was deliberate, that it was conscious. And for the most part, I don't think there might have been individuals, but there was no grand conspiracy going on behind the scenes where this group of people were coming together and said, let's go out and lie to the American people. What happened was they got caught up in the culture, the permanent campaign culture, and it's very destructive when that gets transferred from domestic policy issues and other issues to issues of war, and where issues as grave as the war-making process. When you go to war, you've got to build bipartisan support, and you've got to maintain that support. You can't maintain that support if you aren't as open and honest as possible about things.
Perhaps the most difficult episode for you, you mentioned it was the Valerie Plame incident when
yes.
You say you unknowingly told lies. And here's what must have been a very awkward moment for you standing there at the lectern in the Brady briefing room.
If you'll let me finish.
No, you're not finishing. You're not saying anything. You stood at that podium and said that Karl Rove was not involved, and now we find out that he spoke about Joseph Wilson's wife. So don't you owe the American public a fuller explanation? Was he involved or was he not? Because contrary to what you told the American people, he did indeed talk about his wife, didn't he?
David, there will be a time to talk about this, but now is not the time to talk about it.
Do you think people will accept that, what you're saying today?
Again, I've responded to the question.
Wow. That incident, seemingly reading in your book and all the varying twists and turns, that seemed to, more than anything else, weigh on your decision that, this White House had really gone down the tubes.
Well, it was one of really two that were prominent. That began some of my disillusionment. That was about 10 months before I left the White House, right about 2 years into my time as press secretary. And during that time, when it became known that Karl Rove had been involved in the revealing of Valerie Plame's identity, I was told by White House counsel's office, and it had been our policy prior to that even, that I could not talk publicly about it. We were not commenting. It was ongoing investigation, ongoing legal proceeding. My hands were tied. I couldn't defend words that I had said previously based on conversations with both Karl Rove and Scooter Libby. When I asked point blank, were you involved in this in any way? Both of them unequivocally told me no. I took those assurances and said to White House reporters, they assured me they were not involved in this. And when I couldn't defend myself, your credibility, the credibility for the press secretary is all he's got. Those reporters knew me and they knew that I was a straight shooter, but they actually came to my defense during that period. The reporters were the ones who came to my defense and said, I think he really wants to talk about this. Look, his credibility is unquestionable, and words to that effect. These were White House reporters. But if he can't defend himself, we've got our job to do, and the American people deserve these answers. And so it was a very tough period to go through.
As you know, Chairman Henry Waxman has now requested transcripts of interviews regarding Vice President Cheney and, Scooter Libby's assertion that the vice president may have told him deliberately to leak the name. This comes out in part from your book. Did Vice President Cheney, to your knowledge, order his aides to leak the name of a CIA operative?
I don't know, and I say that in the book. I can't say one way or the other. There was Patrick Fitzgerald, the special prosecutor during the Libby trial, in his concluding remarks, he was responding to Libby's lawyers who said that the prosecutor is trying to put a cloud over the vice president's office. Fitzgerald said, no, it's Libby that has put the cloud over the vice president's office by not being forthright in answering these questions. And I think that's true, very true. The cloud has been left there. I don't know the answer. The president and vice president did direct me through the White House chief of staff to exonerate Scooter Libby. And I said the only way I will do that is if he gives me the same assurances that Karl Rove gave me. And I spoke to him personally, got those assurances, took him at his word, and I shouldn't have.
Let's get another question from the audience here at the museum.
Hi, thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
My name is Dennis Johansson, and I'm from Marion County, Iowa. And my question was, what age, Scott, did you determine you want to become involved in politics? And did that then, and from the answer you gave here when Sidney was up here a minute ago, you were quite young. So did that young age influence your ability to accept what the Bush administration had to say, the philosophies of that administration, and kind of slide into that what you called kind of the philosophy of Washington that allowed you to maybe not have a full view of some of these issues?
No, actually, I don't think that philosophy did. I when I was 4 years old, some of my earliest memories, my mother was elected to the Austin School Board. It was nonpartisan election, but she was a Democrat at the time, became a Republican in the mid-'80s when I was about a senior in high school, just before my senior year in high school. But I grew up, my grandfather taught all his life at the University of Texas Law School. He was dean of that law school for 25 years, really took it to its national prominence. And he used to tell us that it's not the dollars you make, it's the difference you make. That's the kind of philosophy that I was raised on, and that's the kind of philosophy that I'm continuing now in this book. It's an extension of my career in public service, a way to give something back and a way to speak up about what I really believe in.
Thank you very much. We're talking with Scott McClellan about his new book, What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Ron?
Scott, you're surely aware then that this book has become a weapon in Washington. It's become part of the war. It's part of the Punch and Judy show between the parties and among the various parties within the Bush administration still warring over the decisions that were made while you were there. So what's the solution? What can you do, what can any of us do to make Washington different?
Well, I actually talk about some of that at the end of the book, and it has become a little bit of the partisan back and forth. That's the reason for that is because we weren't candid enough in the first place. If we had been candid, then this book would have never been written in the first place. But what we can do about it is, as I say, the most important thing is to embrace openness and candor in government. Then, secondly, what I propose, we've got a presidential election going on here. Both candidates have been talking about changing the way Washington works. Senator Obama talks about changing the way Washington works. Senator McCain has talked about ending the permanent campaign culture, a central theme in my book. I don't think you can completely end it, but you've got to minimize it by putting counterweights in place to the political machine that any administration is going to have in this day and age. And the political advisors have very strong influence. I actually propose a deputy chief of staff for governing, who is a statesman or stateswoman-like figure, who focuses constantly. You've got to focus day in and day out on these issues of making sure you're reaching out, you're engaging in bipartisan deliberation and compromise, that your tone you're setting is elevated, that you're not getting engaged in all this politics is war mentality, the scorched earth politics. What happens is, and I've been involved in plenty of campaigns, including two presidential ones, the campaign mentality doesn't stop when the election's over. Because it becomes so heated and so partisan, it transfers over into the governance. And we've got to be cognizant of that. The presidential candidates need to be starting now about looking at how are you going to get beyond this? How specifically are you going to make sure you change the way Washington works? And we ought to be asking them, what's your plan for doing this? Because it's one thing to talk about it. It's very difficult once you get in there to be able to do it, as I learned.
Email question from Steve in Minneapolis. Is this your last word, or do you know more than what you're saying now?
I don't plan to write another book, if that's what he's asking, but this is not my last word. I intend to continue talking about these issues. If he's asking, is there some information that I held back? No, there's not. There's a certain focus in this book. The narrative was very specific, and I didn't get into a lot of the briefing room activities. I kept it focused on some big picture items.
And what are you going to do? You're currently on the tour, and you have a very successful book out. Beyond that, I assume you want to make a living?
Yes, I'm exploring opportunities. I have been continuing to do some communications work in the meantime, but I am looking at some new opportunities. Obviously, I think there are certain doors that have been closed to me, but there are
a few.
There are also some doors I think that this opens up to where I can continue building on what I wrote in this book.
And if you had, as you watch now this presidential campaign from outside the bubble for the first time in a long time.
Perfectly happy being outside that bubble.
But what's the conduct of the campaign look like to you? Is this a normal politics, or is this especially nasty?
I think it remains to be seen. Senator McCain has said that on the Republican side, he's going to make sure it stays focused on the issues. Senator Obama has pledged the same. Whether or not they can actually, you're going to have all these 527 groups and other side partisan organizations come into play. and you can't control them completely, but are they going to really be able to have a substantive debate on the issues? I think that remains to be seen. They're certainly saying they're going to, but we need to make sure we hold them to that commitment. The nation will be better served.
Scott McClellan, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you. Enjoyed being here, Neil and Ron.
Former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan. His book is What Happened? Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. Coming up, well, Ron Elving is not the political junkie, but nevertheless, he is a political junkie. He'll be with us to recap what happened last night and look ahead to some of the races that we're going to have in November, including a race for, well, Scott McClellan's old boss's job. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.